people who work in those offices are ones who like to be very busy and important all the time. I wasn't of that mind. I like to pace myself and keep a clear head and not be too exhausted. And I thought it was important that the other advisors didn't suffer from exhaustion, and that's because that's the time when your judgment goes.
Mm. So in terms of things like, for example, a meal break, did you have that, or was it a matter of grabbing something on the...
It was often, particularly when the Parliament was sitting, you didn't have a meal break, basically, because question time would be at 2 o'clock and you needed to be prepared. Other times I would try and get out and have a short walk, have a sandwich outside somewhere, sit in a courtyard, just get out of the office for a little while and just have that break.
Mm. And your normal day would finish sort of, you said 10, 11 at night?
Well, if the Parliament was sitting, it could be 10, 11. It could go on longer than that because the Parliament often sat longer than that. If it's a normal day and the minister was... If it's a non-sitting day and the minister was away, then we might get home at 6, 7 o'clock at night.
How would you describe or consider the working conditions here, both working, I suppose, within the office, but also in the building itself?
In the old Parliament House, the working conditions were crowded, to put it politely. We had... I think in the little room where I was, which was a long, narrow room, we had, I think, 4 or 5 advisors plus the press secretary in the one room with the photocopier. And then in the next room, an equally small room, was the senior advisor and, or the private senior private secretary, another advisor and the administrative staff. So we were very much on top of one another, and it was very, very difficult to hear, very difficult to concentrate. Neil had put in a request for some extra space, which is, of course, not really available in the old Parliament House. But eventually we were given what had been an old cupboard under the stairs next to the canteen. And there was a little bit of space in there. I think it would sit 3 people. And so another advisor and I just decided that we were off. We were going to, this was our space. And so we moved, which did mean being out of the main office, which had both its advantages and disadvantages in that you didn't know what was going on for a lot of the time. But it also meant that you could concentrate on your area of policy to advise.
Could you do that while you were the senior member of staff?
No. Once I became the senior private secretary, I had to move into the main office.
Mm. And that office was right on the lower ground floor on the reps wing?
Yes, yes.
Can you remember what the office number was?
I can't remember what the office number was, but I can take you there.
On the lower ground floor, just next to the...
Yes, it was almost under where we're sitting now, I think.
And we're sitting in the Killen room of the... Mm-hmm. The APM&C. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose a question too, for working conditions. Did you get paid for the excess hours you worked above, over, and beyond the normal working day?
You got paid. You got paid an amount. You got an annual salary that was supposed to compensate you for those hours. I think it notionally included overtime. But the reality was that the job involved long hours anyway. So you probably got paid. I think the salary was okay.
I probably know the answer, but I'll ask you. Did work impact on your social and family life?
Yes, it very much did. I didn't start to work in Parliament House until my children had left home. My son went off to university. My daughter had left to go to university in 1983. My son went to university, I think, in 1985. I had undertaken some study. I'd never been to university, and I'd been given special admission into a master's degree starting in 1985. And I worked part-time on that degree in 85 and 86. And so, but I had to suspend when in 1987 I decided I needed to go to work in the minister's office. So once you work in the minister's office, I think the rest of your life goes on hold, because there just was no energy to do much else at all. So my home life suffered, my social life suffered. I did manage to do a bit of bushwalking on weekends, which was a great release for me. But I was basically exhausted. And if I wasn't in the office, I was exhausted somewhere.
When you were working here, the years that you were in this building, did you access all parts of the building and use its facilities, or were they also simply no time for, if, for example, using things like the tennis court or the parliamentary dining room?
I never had time to use those. Mm. I would go to the canteen, we'd get coffees from the canteen, and sometimes we'd get a meal from the canteen. I was never a visitor to the non-members bar. That wasn't something I had the time or the inclination for, although a lot of the staff would go to the non-members bar. So no, I can't say that I used the facilities. We would sit in the courtyard and drink coffee, and that was a very, very nice thing to do. Or we would have perhaps meetings with other staff when we needed to out in the courtyard. Mm. It was very nice.
So you talk about meetings even when you were on a break, in a sense.
Yeah, well, you would say, well, let's, you know, it's time to have a coffee. Let's go and sit in the courtyard and talk about that.
What sort of interaction did you have with staff in other sections and other parts of this building? I mean, that includes other ministerial staff or others.
Yeah, it was on an as necessary basis, I suppose. So you might have a meeting about a particular cabinet submission you were putting in, if it involved another portfolio, or you know, in the case of maybe you would talk to the finance minister's staff about what you were proposing to do, and they'd always inevitably say, no, you not can't do that. We would, of course, liaise with staff in the junior minister's office. And then really it was just informal contact with those staff, but there weren't too many opportunities for that. You might see them at the canteen, you might see them in the courtyard. Those are the ones you knew. I remember when I joined Neil's office, the senior private secretary, Deborah Snow, saying to me that she had found that working in a minister's office was a bit like being in one of a series of armed camps or bunkers, and every so often one of the staff would go over the top and meet with another member of the, perhaps to discuss a treaty or to lob a grenade into another minister's office, but that it was a series of armed camps, she described it as, and that has always resonated with me. I thought, yes, that probably describes it quite well.
You mentioned the junior ministers and their staff. What was the relationship between you and them?
On a staff-to-staff meet basis, it was okay. There were sometimes tensions when a junior minister wanted to do something and the senior minister disagreed, or there was some discussions going on between the staff, and we would say, well, don't really think that's a good idea, and so they might get a bit tetchy. But basically it was okay.
But the staff was completely separate from your area of responsibility.
Yes, each of the junior ministers.
Junior minister also had their own staff.
Responsible directly to that.
So how was the coordination of that work done then? The junior minister presumably can't operate independent of the senior minister.
No, they can't. There would be meetings between the senior and the junior ministers. But they would have their own areas of operation. For example, I think we had Veterans Health in our portfolio at one stage, and that was a sort of discrete area of work. When Peter Staples was the junior minister, he had responsibility for pharmaceutical policy, and that was a big area of work going on at that time, which he did very, very well. So he would talk to our minister, to the senior minister about that area of work. Mm. So it was about the junior ministers having discrete parts of the portfolio to work on. And obviously they needed to liaise with the senior ministers.
But that liaison did not go through you. For example, in terms of, you said, making sure that
the senior minister... I didn't get in the way of the junior minister seeing the senior minister.
And documents and reports and proposals would not sort of come to you to make sure they were on Blewett's desk?
They would come to me as a matter of courtesy, and they would be passed through. But I think there was a lot of liaison between the junior ministers and Neil. Mm. So it was often not necessary for that to happen.
Yeah. Did you ever attend sessions in the chambers?
No. I think I might have sat in there once when there was a bit of a stoush going on over some aspect of Neil's work. But I, by and large, no, we listened to it or watched it on the television. We would watch the question time from the office, or have you know, be partly doing our work and have one eye on the television. But no, we tended not to sit in the chamber, not necessary. And Neil was such a competent minister that he really didn't need his... Once he got something... Once he had decided on a position, once he had thought it through, he was more than capable of holding his own.
Mm.
Mm. I remember once he went into a cabinet meeting with a proposal that he had to argue for, and I think I sent a note in saying, did he want a couple of the senior bureaucrats there? And he just sent a note out saying, no, I can handle this. Or something like, no, I have no need of the Praetorian Guard. Which is a nice note. I thought it said a lot about him.
Mm. A bit of technology. You mentioned television. When was had that been introduced in, and you had the screens in the office before you started?
I think there was a television in Neil's office, not in the advisors' offices. Mm. When we moved up to the new Parliament House, all the offices had televisions. Mm. So we could watch what was going on at any time.
In terms of your own work, what sort of equipment would you have used in your daily work? Were you using word processing, some form of word processing equipment?
I think it was the very early days of computers, but not in the old Parliament House, I don't think. They were in the new Parliament House. We had computers, and we had to have some training on those. But the main thing I can remember from my early days as an advisor was the little yellow sticky notes, which we would put on the documents sent over from the department and say, "I have some concerns about this," or "We think this is okay. Suggest you sign." So there were lots of those little yellow sticky notes that went on to documents. Low technology solutions, yes, indeed.
So did you prefer to stick with the kind of equipment you had used, say, in this building in the early years, working for the minister, when you moved up to the...
Up to the new Parliament House, well, there were computers, and we all needed to be trained in the use of computers. They were the ones with the black screens with orange writing on. So that was an innovation. We obviously had better technology in terms of photocopiers and nice telephones. And so the technology was introduced gradually. I don't have any real memories of any particular hassles with it. Or though there was one, at one point the staff decided that I needed to be on call 24 hours a day. And they acquired a one of those alerts, the alarms, which I sort of duly put in my briefcase and took home and threw my briefcase in the middle of the hall, as I was wont to do when I was very tired, and went to bed, got up the next morning, and I thought, there's a bird singing somewhere. And I sort of potted around, got myself a cup of tea and woke myself up and where is that persistent noise coming from? And eventually I realised it came from my briefcase. It was the beeper saying the office wanted me. I think they stopped trying after that. And the world didn't fall apart. I can't remember what the crisis was, but it probably wasn't a proper one.
I'm talking about the new technology. How much extra space, or how much space did you actually get when you moved up to the Australian
Government? Oh, masses. We had, I think Neil's office was probably twice the size. I shared an office with his senior consultant, and that was more than big enough for two of us, with plus a television, plus some decent furniture. We had 1, 2, 3 other offices for advisors. We had a kitchen. We had a large space where the administrative staff sat and where the paperwork went through, and we had a proper reception area. It was a complete change.
There's actually you mentioned that the number of staff who actually went up and to the Australian mm-hmm. Government House was about to stay the same.
Yeah.
Once you were there.
Yeah.
Because we noted that in 1992, which was after you had left, that Blewitt's staff as Minister for Social Security had increased to 13. So that was a good 30% larger than you mentioned, 10 approximately.
Yeah, I have in my mind that we had a total staff of 16, which included the electoral staff. The staff in the electorate office, there were 3 or 4 of those, plus the driver, plus the staff in the Canberra office.
Oh, that must have been...
Yeah.
This was the number here is for people who actually worked in his personal office in the Australian Parliament
yeah.
House.
Yeah, okay.
So there was not a significant
increase. Not a significant increase, no.
No. Again, come briefly back to the working conditions. Did you have any contact with your colleagues outside of work? In any friendship type contacts with staff or people you worked with here?
There was one woman, Margaret Connolly, who was there when I first went into the office. She and I became good friends. We both disappeared into the broom cupboard office together, and we became very good friends, and we're still very good friends. Mm.
Did you ever, or was there ever, a social club of any kind in this building, Old Parliament House, or in the Australian Parliament House?
If there was, I didn't know about it, and I probably wouldn't have joined it anyway because, as I said earlier, we had no time for much social life or doing anything. We normally just, by the time you got home at night, you were just more than ready to turn right off.
While you were working, certainly in the two Parliament buildings, were you ever a member of a union?
I was a member, and I can't remember how I got to be a member. I was a member of the Australian Journalists Association. And I think that might have been when... I think I might have joined that when I was in the Development Education Unit with ACFOA, because I was doing so much writing, and I kept that membership up for years. Obviously working in the Labor Party, it helped if you were a member of a union.
Were you ever required or requested to take part in any industrial action?
No, no.
How did workloads change, by quantum, during sitting weeks and when the minister was away? You have mentioned that it was dramatically more intense when Parliament was sitting.
Yeah, the pressure was more intense because obviously ministers are accountable to Parliament. When he's in Canberra, the bureaucrats would want to, there would inevitably be stuff that the department needed to see him about. The interest groups would come into Canberra to lobby, so we would have to see a certain number of them. So it was just the pressure was much greater when the Parliament was sitting. There was more going on.
When the Minister was away, did any of you travel with him?
Oh, yes. Yes, he always had one or two advisers, perhaps a secretary and perhaps the press secretary, depending on what engagements he had.
What about you? Did you accompany the Minister at all on his travels?
Oh, yes. Yes, I accompanied him quite a lot, and I went on one overseas trip with him to Europe, to Stockholm and Russia, Hungary, Malta, back to London and then on to the States.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, we were meeting with, we're looking at health systems overseas, obviously, and community service systems overseas. In Malta, we were representing the government at their Independence Day celebrations, which was great fun. In Russia, we were looking at health systems. We were looking at, we'd been asked particularly to look at some particular forms of eye surgery that they were doing, laser eye, that was the early days of laser eye surgery. They were pioneering that in Russia and were anxious to show us what they were doing. In Sweden, similarly, we were discussing their health system, which is, has some similarities to ours.
What year was this?
That was, I think, 1989.
So just the last days of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Yes. Have you got any memories of any stories or anything about what happened on that travel and what impression it made on you?
I saw, well, we were in Moscow. We went to, I think we had a little bit of time in Leningrad and then went on to Moscow. And at my suggestion, we travelled by train from Leningrad to Moscow, which I think the foreign affairs people or the people at the embassy in Russia weren't keen on us doing, but it was quite an interesting trip in that we actually managed to see some of the country rather than just flying over it. I thought Moscow was very grey and depressing, but the people were very hospitable. In fact, they were so hospitable, I don't think I've ever eaten so much in my life. And none of it was vegetables or fruit. So we spent a lot of time eating there, but saw some very interesting stuff, had some discussions with the health ministry and looked at some of their services they were providing.
Did you get any impressions of the end of empire soon being around the corner, or was... I mean, there's certainly the signs of things changing.
Well, no, we were only there for a day or two, so it was a very run-down, shabby country, you know. It was... The hotel had, you know, didn't have the fixtures and fittings that modern hotels had even in those days. Everything looked grey and just shabby.
What was your workload like? What actually did you do when travelling with the minister?
Well, you were there really to carry the bags, advise him, make sure the itinerary, you know, keeping to time. Keeping in touch with the office as far as you could without the modern technology that we have nowadays. So it was really very much a supporting role in supporting the minister to carry out his ministerial duties.
What about travelling in within Australia? Was that a more regular occurrence?
Yes, I mean there would be quite frequent trips to Adelaide and all round the place, just depending on where he needed to go. You didn't get to see much of the country. You were really sort of traipsing from one appointment to another.
And that, I suppose, in terms of travel, also election times. There were a number of elections during the years you were involved with both the ALP and the government and in the parliament.
Yeah, I joined in 1987, just after the 87 election. Mm. And then I left just about the time of the 1990 election. So I wasn't very much involved in the election campaigns.
But you mentioned earlier last time that you also you were heavily involved with the Hawke 83 election.
Yes, because I was a party apparatchik during election times. Mm. The party really has to swing into action and run things. It doesn't run government, but it runs the campaign for election. So you're very, very much involved at that stage, far more than people in ministers' offices are, because the ministers have to be out there promoting what they've done and what they intend to do. But basically, the I guess the ringmaster is the party at that stage, whereas in government, the person who's at the head of it all is the Prime Minister. When in an election campaign, the ministers are out on the campaign trail, but they're very much the secondary players to the Prime Minister, because all the cameras are on the Prime Minister.
And the staff involved, I mean, in the Hawke 83 election, you were then working for the ALP.
But no, I was seconded onto Hawke's staff to work directly for him during the 83 campaign.
So, what was that like?
That was campaign? Very exciting. That was a terribly exciting campaign. It was one of those election campaigns where everybody knew it was a time for a change. The party had just switched leaders to Hawke, which was a cause of some grief to a lot of us. But, you know, we all picked ourselves up and said, okay, Hawke's leader, we're going to go on with this and we're going to win. And there was a real sense that we were going to win. Hawke was very good. He adapted very quickly to the role of leader. My job was to be one of two people who went on ahead of the main party around Hawke to make sure that things were in place in the electorates that he was going to visit. So that my job was to make sure that there were microphones that worked, that the itinerary had been planned out well, that the timings were correct, and that everything would go smoothly for the main party when they arrived. And that was a good role because it allowed me a certain amount of freedom. But every so often the main party would catch up with me and so I'd be part of the larger group again.
That brings me to another idea. I mean, and perhaps then also, you supervised staff. And both you had staff to supervise in the office when you worked for the minister as well.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe your style of management?
Oh, that's a hard one. I'd had no formal management training, and I can look back and see I think I had a lot of trust in the staff to make good decisions. But at the same time, I think I could be quite autocratic at times. And that probably was not the best way of handling things. I think I probably could have had a more consultative style of management. But, you know, I'd had no formal management training. I did what I felt was the right thing at the time. I think I'd always wanted to be bossy, and so I think I was bossy.
On the other hand, you also mentioned that you agreed with a statement that, in a sense, your role was to make it happen.
Yes.
How reconcile that with consultation and?
I think it's more just about a style of leadership. Yeah. I think probably the latest management thinking would be that having that more consultative, collaborative approach is probably more effective. But the only way I did it, the only way I knew how at that time, and it was really learning it by doing it. And, you know, the office did work. I think I got a lot of feedback from the department saying they'd never seen such a well-organised minister's office, and I remember the minister saying something to that effect, but perhaps not quite so politely at one stage, that his office was sort of organised down to the last teaspoon or something like that.
Well, did you initiate any changes in office procedures or practices while you were working in the minister's office?
I think the main change I instituted was making sure that people got time off. And that I thought that was a very important reform because I saw people working themselves to death, being exhausted, not making good decisions, perhaps being a bit ratty, a bit bad-tempered, just not as effective as I knew they could be. Mm. So my main reform was to make sure everybody, including the minister, got time off. And I think that was an important thing to do. I still see ministers' offices that work, you know, 24 hours a day, and that's when governments get into trouble, in my view.
Shall we take a break here?
Let's take a break.